to the church about how my back was hurting last week and last night. Oh, man. Sorry. I'll talk louder than that. There I am. Are you ready? Here I come. last night, Grant and Susan dropped off a meal at our house, and Grant said, "How's your back feeling?" I said, "Better than last weekend." So I'm just stretching a little bit real quick because it's been one of those days and nights as a parent of four kids. So you just all just pause for a second and pray for me, and then I'll preach, okay? I have this game that I play with myself. I don't love problems with my teeth. Like, I don't like that at all. Like, whenever you have that little twinging feeling when you realize that there's something wrong, or you, like, you see something whenever you're looking in the mirror after you brush your teeth. Some of you, I'm sorry, this is very triggering. I apologize. But when you have that, like, little, you bit down on something, and then you're like, oh, that's probably nothing. Like, do you know what I'm talking about? Like, I say that to myself all the time. Like, oh, that's probably nothing. And then, like, a few days go by and, like, nothing's happened. My tooth feels great. And then I bite down on another, like, just the right piece of crunchy bread that was exactly the right size and shape that it triggered this tiny little place where I have this little cavity that I'm like, or this little loose filling or a loose crown or whatever. And it just feels like this, like, little twinging pain that somehow I convince myself over the course of a few days or a few weeks or even a month, it's probably nothing. And then I take a bite and I'm like, that is definitely something and it needs to be taken care of. Are you with me? Like, so what happens in my life is I go one of two routes with my teeth then. I either pick up the phone and I call the dentist, or I spend the next weeks just continuing in denial, because to admit what was going on would take some serious intervention from someone outside of myself. If I could pray or worry away problems with my teeth, I would fix everything, because I'm good at praying and worrying away problems with my teeth. This is so intimate and personal. I hope this is okay. And so I started thinking about this passage this morning and thinking, how do we talk about sin in the church? How do we talk about community? And how do we talk about Christ's presence with us? And this teeth metaphor is something that just kept ringing in my ears. And I'm going to set it aside for a little while, but I want us to think about, what does it mean that there is something that really, truly does need to be taken care of? Whether it's our teeth or in a relationship with someone else, whether it's professionally or with our vehicles, there comes to be a point where we realize something needs to be done about this. Like, something should happen. Usually when it comes to this passage, I'm cautious to preach it, because I know how sideways things go. It's like if I tried to give myself a root canal this afternoon if I had a bad tooth. Are you with me? I'm not qualified. I can't do that. I have almost no there's almost no good possibility that could result in me trying to give myself a root canal. Right? And I know some people who've done self-extractions. So, part of why this passage is scary is because when it comes to sin in the church, maybe just the word sin, and then when it comes to going and speaking into each other's lives, or a community speaking into someone's lives, we've seen it go wrong enough times that it's daunting and triggering to think about it. To even, like, bring up the conversation of talking about sin in each other's lives. Because we've seen too many times when someone well-meaning went to someone else and said something that was hurtful or harmful, or power was wielded by a community over someone else in an unhealthy and unhelpful way. The problem is that in alerting someone else to it, they thought that they were the ones to remedy the situation. And after a week of sitting with this passage, I would like to say, before we even get started, I can't say started, I've been preaching for 4 minutes. before we even get started, that God is the one who heals and forgives. I'm going to say that again so we all hear it. God is the one who deals with sin. God is the one who heals and forgives and redeems and restores. That's not our job. But sandwiched between, thank you, Paul, for your leading and your preparation. It was perfect. Before this passage, there's three passages here that are sandwiched together in Matthew 18, verses 10 to the end of the chapter. The first chunk of verses talk about a love that seeks us out. That's the man, the guy who has 100 sheep, and one of them wanders off, and he leaves the 99 to go and find the one. That's the passage right before this one. This passage, so that's about like a love that seeks us out. This passage talks about a love that's willing to confront in community. I'm going to say it again. A love that's willing to confront in community. And that's these five verses from 15 to verse 20. And then from verse 21 to the end of the chapter is about an abundant and abounding forgiveness that comes from God and flows out to each other and into the world. So in the middle, in this very hard passage from 15 to 20 in Matthew 18, we have a passage on our God who loves us and who seeks us out even when we're lost, and a passage about deep forgiveness that comes from God in abundance over a multitude of wrongs and debts, and that is then expected to live out in how we treat each other. That's where this hard passage about community comes. It's not standing on its own on stilts. Right? It's like the circus is coming to town. I went to Food Max the other day, and they had a big poster. It said, a real circus is coming to town. And I was like, oh my, that sounds very interesting. I think about someone up on 15-foot stilts trying to balance and make it through, or people with more skill, maybe they're doing it very smoothly, better than I dance. But I think that we don't take this passage up on stilts, shaky as it is, and then try to build up support. It comes with support, and the support is the 10 verses before it and the 15 verses after it and the whole context of our biblical canon, which helps us understand who God is and who we are as people. That's my preamble for this sermon. Last week, Irvin preached on loosing. You can find it online if you haven't heard it. It's very helpful. He preached on loosing on earth what is loosed in heaven, unilateral forgiveness. Thank you for that quote from Catherine Marshall. The release that we give to others, even when they haven't asked for it, releasing someone into God's good hands and reminding us that all of us need forgiveness. All of us need forgiveness. And we're skipping ahead to Matthew 18 because that's what the lectionary does, from Matthew 16 to Matthew 18. One writer that I read framed these chunks of verses as the three other-oriented concerns of love. The other-oriented concerns of love. The parable of the wandering sheep with God's love seeking us out. The teaching about God's about love that confronts others. That's this passage. And then love that forgives others. This is good news, and it's the good news of love that searches for us and finds us. It's the good news of love that calls us to be willing to confront with humility and sensitivity and courage. And this is the good news of that calls us to forgive. But I'm not going to preach a sermon on forgiveness because you heard a good sermon last week, and that's the text for next week. So I'm going to set that aside. If you take time to read Matthew 18 tonight, after what all the things are done, you'll find a lot packed into this chapter. You'll find judgment. God is righteous judge about what we do actually mattering, about plucking out eyes and cutting off other things that are causing us to sin because of how disruptive sin is, not just in the present, but in all time. Judgment. God's love that finds us is a love that's searching for us as we are lost. And while we're all created in the image of God, not while, I'm sorry, we are all created beautifully and wonderfully and uniquely in God's image. And this is a passage about sin and how messed up things get whenever things have gone wrong, things that have been done or things that have been left undone. Isaiah 53 verse 6 says, "We all like sheep have gone astray, each of us have turned our own way." When I was in high school in Johnstown, I sang in the Johnstown Symphony Chorus, and we sang the Messiah, and it was the first time I had ever heard the Messiah. And now some of you are like, really? It was the first time you heard the Messiah at age 18? Yes, it was the first time that I heard. We didn't engage that sort of high choral tradition where in my home context. We sang it, and I hear it. "All we like sheep have gone astray." That's even more difficult than that new song you taught us, Sarah. I love that. It was beautiful. I took a picture of the page so I can go back and sing it later, hopefully with a better bass line than I just showed Irvin and Bonnie. Hopefully they didn't hear me too good. I just hear those words of the Messiah roaring over and over in my brain as I was writing this down. But Matthew 18, 15 to 20 isn't just about being lost, and it's not just about sin. It's also about community. It's about being the church together. It's about loosing and binding and freedom. And it's ultimately about Christ's presence in the church. Christ's presence with those who follow Jesus, even when they're gathered in the smallest groupings, even in just twos and in threes. We don't have to have 100 or 150 or 250 or 1,000 people for Christ's presence to then show up. Look at the passage. Jesus doesn't say in twos or threes, "I will be there." He says, "I am there." Christ's presence with us. And that's not just that's whenever we're hungry and Jesus feeds 5,000. Yes, that's whenever he calls Levi, who's an outsider. Yes, that's whenever they're on the boat and they think they're going to die. And yes, that's when the church engages in the hard work of community, confronting sin and turning towards Jesus as we all believe the good news. To live out what Christ is calling us to do and to be, we have to believe, one, that it is good news, that the shepherd who leaves the 99 to find the one, that's the mouth from which we're hearing these words, the mouth of the shepherd. We have to believe, too, that the community of searched for and saved ones is worth it. I'm going to say that again. We have to believe that the community of searched for and saved ones is worth it. Because in my home family, in my family context, I do the hard conversations with my siblings. I listen through the hardest moments. I move forward and I actually receive their words into my heart and into my life because I know that that relationship, that home, my family relationship with my siblings, with my parents. And I know that's not the same for all of you. I know that's not the same for all of the relationships you have with your parents and with your siblings. So just hear me for me. Whenever my brother sits me down and says something to me that's hard, I listen. Not because I think he has a perfect read on my life. We live hundreds of miles away. But because he deeply loves me. And if he's risking speaking something into my life, I'm going to listen. And then we're going to talk about it. We have to believe that the community of searched for and saved ones is worth it, the church. And three, we have to believe that the shepherd who command, we have to believe the shepherd who commands us to do so. Jesus tells us that we have to speak into each other's life in hard and robust and difficult ways at times. Whenever I read the passage for the first time about a week ago, not for the first time in my life, but about a week ago, I started reading and it said, "If your brother or sister sins." Really, I'm not a Greek, if you know me by now. I'm not a Greek fella, but it really says if another follower of Jesus sins, and the best way to translate it is brother or sister, but if goodness gracious, like if someone else sins, if that's like whenever we leave to go on a date and we leave the kids with a babysitter and we're like, if one of the kids happens to poop somewhere. Or right? Wait, I wrote down a couple good ones. If milk happens to be spilled, if someone causes someone else to bleed in the next 2 hours from hand, head, foot, or face. Like, if, when someone, right? It's if when this happens, go and point out their fault just between the two of you. And what's just going to someone one-on-one does, usually, is it protects the dignity of the person that you're talking to. It protects them from public shaming. It protects you as the person who's going and talking to them from being embarrassed if you're wrong. And whenever we would do kids club trainings, we would talk about perceived misbehavior. So when a worker or when a teacher, like as a teacher, when I think there might be something that's not going right, does that make sense? That's very different than going in and saying when a kid has done something that was not right or that was wrong or something like that. It's when there's a perceived misbehavior, whenever you think there might be something that's gone wrong, that's when you're going. And going one-on-one in a lot of contexts helps save a lot of people a lot of blushes. There's an old Crow Medicine Show song from my college days that was called Let It Alone. It's like, let it alone, if it don't concern you, let it alone. And it's all about not getting into other people's business. Now, the song doesn't stack perfectly with this passage, but I will say that for some of us, getting into other people's business and telling them what they should or should not do isn't hard for us. Some of us don't mind at all getting into other people's business. And some of us, it's the most terrifying thing I could suggest from the pulpit. Going to someone that you care about and speaking into their lives is terrifying. And so we find ourselves yet again caught on this balanced continuum. And the invitation is with humility and with love to live this sort of gritty, thick relationships that make us willing to, but not overly anxious to, not without good reason. Now, there's a lot of things that happen in a lot of scenarios where it's not good and it's not safe for you as someone who has been wrong to go and talk to the wrongdoer. I'm not talking about that. I know some of you have already thought about that, okay? There are lots of times in the church where people who have been harmed have them and asked to go to the person who harmed them. I'm not talking about those situations. Set it aside for now. And if we want to talk about it later, come and talk to me. I'd be happy to talk about that. But for other situations, this can serve sometimes as a helpful blueprint for how the church within the church confronts sin. While there's wisdom in not creating conflict triangles with neighbors and other folks who aren't in the church, who aren't believers, who aren't disciples, this isn't meant to be how we interact with the world around us. Does that make sense? It's like if you see something wrong and you feel compelled every single time to go and tell the person why they think that they should do something different, maybe you should just relax a little bit with that. This Matthew 18 is talking about how we treat each other within the context of community. Now, I will say that yesterday, I called WHSV for the first time. I called them because I saw something that was wrong, and I said, that needs to be fixed. Because collective bargaining agreements and collective borrowing are two different things. And the headline on their website said, Harrisonburg City Schools have struck a collective borrowing agreement, which doesn't make any sense. So I did call them and pointed out something that wasn't in the church and asked them to fix the typo on their website because I thought it would sow confusion and distrust. You don't need to know that. I'm sorry. Okay. I'm coming back. The shepherd who leaves the 99 for the one and the passage about forgiveness on the other. I have 4 minutes, so you can set your timer if you want or just take a deep breath. And let me finish this. The passage before it about seeking out the lost one and the passage after it about forgiveness are meant for restoration. The goal is restoration. It's not flexing our muscles. And whenever I've seen these stuff go wrong in the church and in individual relationships, it usually has to do with power. feels like it starts to feel weird and sideways. This is about mutual humility and vulnerability. This is about the goal of and the hope of restoration, redemption, and it's about moving forward. How does it say within our team covenant, Lori? I think it says moving with imagination or curiosity whenever we think that there's something wrong, moving towards what we think is the problem. We're not left to do this church work alone. We're not left to do the hard work alone. We're not even left to forgive on our own. It is Christ's presence with us as followers of Jesus, even in the smallest expression of the church, where Jesus says, I am there. Here's my challenge to you. My challenge for us this morning is, within this passage, how do we think about ourselves in it in both sides of the story? Both as the one who is perceiving something that's wrong, something that's gone awry, something that is broken, and how someone else has acted towards someone else, right? The clear-cut stuff. How do we move forward as someone who sees it and then goes and talks to someone? And how do we read this passage as someone who is someone is coming and talking to them? Because whenever I flipped the story in my brain to the other side of the coin, and I thought, what would it feel like if Jamie came and said, Seth, we got to talk. Like, it's terrifying, right? So I wanted to think, how can I prepare my heart to see the ways that people move towards me to speak in my life with sincerity and with even a sense of gratitude? Like, I don't know. Like, Jamie, we didn't talk about this, so there's nothing between Jamie and I, okay? Okay, everyone got it? Like, honestly, like, if Jamie is going to come and talk to me, or if Doug is going to come and talk to me, or if Dawn is going to come and talk to me, or if Susan's going to come and talk to me and say something to me, I trust those people. I love them. We might not see perfectly eye to eye on everything, but if they're going to work up the mustard to come and talk to me, how can I sit and actually listen to them and not pull up big, whenever we were teaching at the beginning of COVID, they gave us these big plexiglass plastic things that we thought would save us, right? We wore masks. I'm a special ed teacher, like, by trade. And so I was in the classroom every day after that first spring finished, when most people were still online. And like, they give us these big plexiglass. And I think whenever we see someone coming to speak into our lives, for some of us, for me, and for some of us, we pick up those big plexiglass things and we set them in front of ourselves, maybe out as a defense mechanism, or maybe because we have good reason that we feel like we have to. I'm just saying that for me, as I look at this passage, I need to figure out a way to not pick up big plexiglass barriers and block people from speaking into my life. I need to somehow see the people who love me as maybe moving towards me with the best intentions, because they deeply care and they deeply love me. So what does all this mean for us as the church? That's my challenge. I want you to read the passage in both lenses at some point today, if you can, and then read it with both wing passages, pericopes, I think is the word. That's a fancy word. With the other two pieces around it, right? The lost sheep one and the forgiving servant. Read those three stories together, and then I'd love to hear what you think about it when you read it in the context of those other two, because it was a game changer for me. I will say that for Zion, for this church community, I think that this is something that, like, is not scary, because we really love each other. And when you really love each other, that takes away, perfect love helps with some of that fear stuff, doesn't it? So I think that what we can do as a church is we can continue to really love each other. And we can really continue to recognize that no expression of the church, not even in just two or three people, like, is without Christ's presence there with us. And then we can continue to do the beautiful and hard work of being the church, because I can make a list of about 100 times where I've seen that, because of the way you've treated me and the way you've treated each other. Can I pray and then we'll sing a song? Sarah, do you want to come up and get ready to sing the song? I'll pray. I don't usually pray at the end of sermons. God, I just want to say thank you. for this church community, this thick church community that really genuinely loves each other. God, I pray that you would continue to equip us to love each other well, to recognize that we don't have to be the ones who deal with the sin problem, but we do need to encourage and in humility be in relationship with each other, even when that means really hard stuff. Give us grace, God. Give us grace upon grace as we care for each other and as we bear witness to your good news. In Jesus' name we pray. Amen.